This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, during global heat records, a world-scale carbon burst is still pouring out of Canada's northern wildfires, bigger than the emissions of most countries. Explore with Professor Justin Angle, author of This Is Wildfire, How to Protect Yourself, Your Home, and Your Community in the Age of Heat. Then, Rethinking the Big Picture, Adrian Carr's new work, Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. Hi, I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. No doubt you heard the hot news. September and early October smashed heat records around the world, and not just by a little. Normally reserved climate scientist Zeke Hausfather said, "This month was, in my professional opinion as a climate scientist, absolutely gobsmackingly bananas." The Japanese reanalysis found September 2023 beat the prior monthly record by over half a degree centigrade and was around 1.8 degrees C warmer than pre-industrial levels. So this September was half a degree centigrade hotter than any temperature ever recorded for the month. We've never seen such a big heat jump. Earth sailed past the supposed 1.5 degree C safety guardrail for at least that month. Many of you lived through it. How great to get summer weather in October. Back to the beaches. Unless, of course, you are a plant, an animal, or a farmer who depends on growing seasons. European countries sizzled. Poland was 4 degrees warmer than the previous hottest September. Switzerland, where 10% of the glaciers in the Alps melted in the last 2 years alone, it was 3.8 degrees C hotter. France was 3.6, along with the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Austria. The Caribbean experienced record-breaking heat. And then Professor Elliot Jacobson says the most extreme global temperature anomalies going on right now are in the tropics, where the temperatures are averaging about 0.7 degrees C above the recent 1991 to 2020 baseline, end quote. Weather historian Maximiliano Herrera reports on October 6th, "The Middle East in rewriting world climate history yesterday, new national October records, Iran 46.6 at Bandar el-Dair, Oman 45.2 at Hamra ad-Daru. The world's hottest minimum temperature for an October night was recorded this week in Abu al-Bukush in the United Arab Emirates. If that 33.9 degrees C nighttime low, 93 degrees Fahrenheit, is officially confirmed, we have a new nighttime high for October on this planet. It was 33 degrees C in the capital of Doha overnight as well. Just imagine." September 2023 in Peru, says Herrera, was record hot and also witnessed the highest temperatures in its climatic history. The October heat was cooking and breaking records across northern South America in countries like Bolivia, Guyana, and more. It was all over. Eastern China broke October heat records, and you know Japan has been baking in a heat wave lasting months. It is surrounded by seas hotter by far than anything seen before. And it is not just the northern hemisphere. According to Herrera, who is a climatologist, September 2023 in New Zealand had an average temperature of 11.9 degrees C, which is 1.3 degrees C above the 1991-2020 normal, and was the warmest September on records. Australia is already very hot, and it's early in the spring. A few fires already sprang up in New South Wales. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology just released its forecast for this El Niño year. Australians should expect 3 months of dry, blistering heat in their summer. The conditions mirror the great fire times of the last El Niño in 2015-2016. This looks like another tough summer of awful headlines for our Australian friends. You get the idea. Earth just experienced a new jump in heat. We don't know how long it will last, what it will change, what it means. Models did not predict this. Scientists are scrambling to find out why. Professor Stefan Rahmstorf, a trusted source, tweets, We do understand the global warming caused by fossil fuels. For four decades, it has been going as predicted. But we don't understand the surprise upward leap that is happening now, and that worries me," end quote from Stefan Rahmstorf. Me too. Despite producing a dozen programs this year about abrupt climate change and the fragility of Earth's systems, I find myself shocked, sad, and out of words. Why didn't scientists see this big jump in global temperatures coming? Well, a few did. James Hansen, working with records of how temperatures go up to a new plateau with each El Niño, predicted, quote, that 2024 is likely to be off the chart as the warmest year on record, end quote. But even Hansen did not see a huge jump in temperature in 1 month this soon at the start of October in both hemispheres. Regular listeners have heard various guests on this show talk about the possibility of sudden, surprising, abrupt climate change. I focused on the instability of the system since spring. We did not see this in the past. We are in a brand new situation. So Michael Mann, the inventor of the famous hockey stick and the climate warrior, has a new book out. He's doing interviews, and he is selling hope, even of 1.5 degrees for the future. Well, we may breach that this year or the next. Mann criticizes doomers who will discourage the public, even if they do turn out to be right. Perhaps scientists should not tell the public the whole frightening truth because they will lose hope, and then, well, we'll all just party with fossil fuel power until we drop. We're doing that anyway. But I strongly disagree with Dr. Mann, as much as I respect him. Tell the truth to anyone who will listen. This is Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
Also in October, smoke from Canadian wildfires clouded the air over Miami, about 3,000 kilometers or 1,900 miles away from the megafires in Ontario and Quebec. Those fires started in May and will keep going until deep snow puts them out, assuming winter comes. The wildfires are worse in Canada's north, like British Columbia, Alberta, and the Northwest Territories. Greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are pouring out of those vast burning trees right into the atmosphere. None of that is included in the comforting forecasts coming from the politicians and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Fire is in the driver's seat. Record-setting megafires scorched North America this summer. These fires released more greenhouse gases than most countries of the world. They burned thousands of homes and forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate. Harmful fire smoke covered continents. What a perfect time for a clear, down-to-earth fire manual for us all. It is called This is Wildfire: How to Protect Yourself, Your Home, and Your Community in the Age of Heat. The authors are Montana journalist and award-winning podcaster Nick Mott and fellow public radio broadcaster Professor Justin Angle. He is from the University of Montana. Their podcast and radio show is called Fireline. The new book is full of helpful tips with a message that will be controversial for some of you. From Missoula, Montana, Justin Angle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Justin, your life is sort of complicated. You were a triathlon athlete in New England, then with a finance master's degree, a bond trader, and now?
My life has sort of had a few different distinct phases. You know, I studied business as a college student and got into the bond markets and then did a stint as a rowing coach because I was a rower as a student. You know, that experience taught me that working on campus was something I wanted to do, so I went back to graduate school and earned a PhD and landed here as a business professor. Now, that still doesn't draw a clean line to why I was involved in wildfire, in a wildfire book, but here in Missoula, Montana, we sit at an epicenter for wildfire science, fire management, fire fighting, and fire is part of this community, and much important work is being done here, and I wanted to understand it. And as I set out to try to understand it, it became clear that few citizens, you know, in this area, but also in the country in general, had really an understanding of how we got to this place we're at with wildfire and how we move forward. And so the opportunity to collaborate with Nick on the Fireline podcast came about. That podcast was well received, and it led to this book opportunity. So not exactly a straight line to where I am today, but it's been a fun ride.
And you're in a good place now. Well, at Harvard, Professor Richard Wrangham suggested mastering fire could be essential to human evolution. How so?
Yeah, so Richard Wrangham, in his book, Chasing Fire, and, you know, we came across Richard through his book and had the opportunity to interview him for Fireline, but he was one of the first anthropologists to propose the theory that the moment we became human was the moment that we learned how to control fire. And the mechanism through which that worked was by being able to control fire, we were able to cook our food. And cooking our food allowed for us to ingest the sort of calories we'd need to fuel a big brain, the big brain that modern human beings have. And so that basic evolutionary moment, or that basic moment of ingenuity by early primates, set in motion an evolutionary process that led to, you know, what modern humans are today. And in some ways, it's kind of ironic that, you know, our attempt to control fire sort of also led to an obsession with burning that has done many things to contribute to climate change and the moment we're at with wildfire and other natural disasters that our planet's experiencing.
Your book contains chapters about how to make a home more fire-resistant and community organizing both before and after a fire. And speaking of that, intense and deadly fires are popping up in unexpected places like Greece and Hawaii. Justin, have we come to the point where every community and government needs a wildfire plan?
I think every community should have a wildfire plan. It's just a good exercise for a community to go through, to think about the critical risks, to think about its infrastructure, its policies, how safe its communities are as far as entry and exit and evacuation plans and so forth, and how fuels are managed in the community. Because to your point, yes, I think we're seeing fires in places that we haven't expected them. We're seeing them happen at times of the year where they have not historically happened, at least not in recent history. So we have a built environment that much of it has not been constructed with wildfire in mind. And I think the more communities that start considering wildfire, the stronger those communities will be when and if fire comes their way.
So you do cover climate change in fires, and we will get to that. But first, you try to overcome a mass misunderstanding about the role of fire in Western forests. What was the situation, say, in California, before the European settlers arrived?
First of all, indigenous folks have been using fire and lived in conjunction with fire for millennia and managed wildfire. They didn't view it as, they viewed it as something to be respected as part of nature, as a gift in many ways, and they introduced fire onto the landscape. The historical record shows this. And they did it in a way that helped the ecosystem stay in balance. It helped them prepare their grounds for ceremony, but also for agriculture and rejuvenation. So there's been a long tradition of, you know, intentional burning on the landscape for long before European settlers were here. And natural fire was allowed to play a role on the landscape in a way that, you know, might seem unfamiliar to folks now. You know, we hear of fire years that burn, you know, 10 million acres here in the U.S., and that's considered a giant fire year. And in by recent standards, those are really large fire years. But before European settlement, parts of the West in particular, a 10 million acre fire year was not considered to be such a large number. Yeah, it wasn't out of the ordinary. So, you know, it's really the rise of fire suppression that has reduced the amount of fire on the landscape. And what we're living through now is kind of some of the consequence of putting out all that fire, because there's actually a deficit of fire in our system. And we can talk about that a little bit more if you'd like.
I'm sure we will get to that. That's a key point in the book. But could you just explain a bit more about indigenous fire management and what that might suggest for today?
Absolutely. So we had the great privilege of spending an afternoon with the late Tony Incashola Sr. and his son Tony Incashola Jr., who are two members of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe, and they live north of Missoula on the Flathead Indian Reservation. Sr. was long part of the Culture Committee, and Jr. Is in charge of fire management for the tribes. And they described some of that history, and they did so by taking us to this particular place called the Jocko Prairie. It's an area, a riparian area. It's sort of in the foothills of some large mountains adjacent to some really dense, lush forests. And for many, many years, this land fire was excluded from this landscape. Kind of the European standard of suppressing all fires was the standard on this piece of land. And the land had become quite unhealthy, unappealing, choked with debris. Cattle were grazing on that land, so that was another factor that led to it being out of balance. And historically, the tribe had used fire and had lived in conjunction with fire. It was not viewed as something to be afraid of, and it was not viewed as something to be put out. And so elders in the tribe advocated to reintroduce fire to the landscape, and it was a long process to try to do that. And what I mean by introducing fire to the landscape, it's sort of the intentional introduction of fire, so setting fire intentionally. And, you know, and we can get into the mechanics of that. But in terms of this particular piece of land, you know, you get buy-in from the tribes, buy-in from the community, and introduced a prescribed burn, a low-intensity burn that cleared out a lot of the underbrush, a lot of the trees that were being overshadowed by larger trees. And the forest quickly became much more healthy. The larger trees that withstood the fire, I mean, they had been adapted to withstand fire. Large ponderosas, for example, they became more healthy. The understory became easier to move through, much more in balance.
Well, let's move to climate and the fires that we're seeing. Does science show that wildfires are increasing in the United States, say even since 1980? And has the nature of those fires changed as well?
Yeah, so the first thing is we got to think about how we measure fire. So in terms of acres burned, the number of acres burned has been growing over the last 10 to 15 years, and there's some variation in there. The number of fire starts has not changed in a meaningful way over the last 20 years. We're experiencing about the same number of fire starts on an annual basis. Fires are getting more destructive, though, so the fires that do escape suppression efforts grow larger and burn hotter and can spread more quickly than they used to be. Fire seasons are longer. Fire season now is about 80 days longer than it was 30 years ago. And you know, rather than calling it a fire season, we might just call it a fire year. You know, one of the most devastating wildfires in the United States happened over New Year's, essentially the Marshall Fire outside of Boulder, Colorado. So yeah, we're experiencing fires at different times of the year. The fires are more intense and they're more destructive. And one of the key reasons they're more destructive, and this is important to keep in mind, is that we've built more and more homes and more structures in places that are prone to burning. So, you know, it's not that these places are burning in unprecedented ways necessarily. It's just that we've happened to build a lot of our homes in these places, and that's the primary cause of the destruction rather than the fire itself, if you think about it from that perspective. But yeah, there's a few different dimensions to how to quantify fire. Acres burned is not necessarily the best dimension, but on several measures, the intensity and overall volume of fires has certainly increased.
And do we have the science to directly link some of those changes to climate change, to heating the planet with burning fossil fuels?
Yeah, the science has a pretty simple intuition, and that intuition is the warmer the temperature, the more fires we have. We talked to a climate scientist at Montana State University, Kathy Whitlock, and she explained one of the methods that her and her colleagues used to document this relationship. And so they drill down into the bottom of lakes and pull out these long tubes that are called sediment cores. So by looking at a sample of the sediment at the bottom of the lake, it's like an historical record of the climate. And you can see, you know, based on the pollens that they detect, you know, what sorts of plants were growing. And if you know what type of plants are growing, you know what kind of temperature range was happening. And if you know the temperature range, you also see evidence of fire in this core when you see, you know, different patterns of charcoal. The science shows that the warmer the temperatures on the planet, the more fires we have. That's the simple intuition. You know, one of the reasons that that plays out is this concept called vapor pressure deficit. So when the air is hotter, when the temperature is higher, more moisture is drawn out of the system, vegetation is drier, both the vegetation that's living and also the vegetation that has, you know, is dead on the ground, all of that is fuel. And if the fuel is drier, if conditions are warmer, then you're going to have more fire. In fact, Kathy and her colleagues told us that we're actually in what's called a fire deficit, that based on the temperatures that we're experiencing, we should actually have more fire than we have now. And we can talk about why we don't, but that's just something that listeners should be aware of, is based on, you know, the warming that we're experiencing, that we should expect more fire to be in the system.
With every big season, social media and even mainstream media blare about arsonists setting fire, but most of the fires, at least here in Canada, almost 99 out of 100, were started by lightning storms, not arson. So you looked into why humans dwell on simplistic explanations. Why is the arsonist conspiracy so popular, and is it a kind of fire or climate denial?
Man, I don't know if it's necessarily fire or climate denial. It's climate denial in the sense that, you know, if people say that arson is becoming, you know, more rampant, that can excuse us from thinking that the climate is driving any of the increase in fires. I think the arson, whether you want to classify it as a conspiracy or an explanation or this sort of obsession and attention that arson gets, because it provides us with an easy culprit, right? If we can blame the actions of a single person as one bad actor, we don't then have to consider the broader instability in our system. And if we think of arsons as the proximal cause of our fire problem, we just need to lock up all the arsonists, right? And that's kind of a simple thought process. But if we have to think about, like, whoa, you know, the climate's changed and we've built our homes in places they maybe shouldn't be built, and we've built with materials and designs and constructed our neighborhoods in risky ways, those are much bigger sort of look in the mirror type of problems that are much harder to address with solutions.
Right. Well, a central theme in This is Wildfire is bound to be controversial. You argue, with some science to back it up, that we should fight fire with fire. What is a prescribed burn association?
A prescribed burn association is something that we're seeing more of across the West and in southwestern United States and some areas in the middle parts of the continent as well. It's a collection of local landowners that want to introduce fire onto their land. You know, and it's not uncommon for private landowners to, you know, have slash piles and burn those piles. It's a pretty common thing, at least here in Montana and certainly other places I've traveled to. But doing it at a scale that manages the level of fuel on the landscape, that tries to return a forest to some balance, that tries to simulate the role that periodic wildfire historically played on the landscape, doing that at a scale where it has an impact on the health of an ecosystem is difficult. And it takes coordination, it takes training, it takes management. It's a hard thing for any one landowner to do, both pragmatically and in terms of the regulations and so forth. The agencies, at least here in the States, say they want to introduce more prescribed burning on federal and state lands. That's really hard to do. And the only agency that's been able to increase its burning has been the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So an alternative model that's arisen are these prescribed burning associations, which are, like I said, these localized organizations that are trying to do this at a scale that can affect their local ecosystems. And it's a pretty successful model. I mean, we don't want any individual landowners just going out and setting fire to their property without the right resources, training, and safety measures put in place. And so these associations are a mechanism that seems promising as a way to introduce more fire onto the landscape and, you know, allow fire to play more of its natural role in the ecosystem.
But this sets up a basic paradox. A few years back, we had Swiss scientist Thomas Crowther on Radio EcoShock, and he explained planting billions of trees could reduce overall global warming. And some countries are planting trees on a massive scale. But is that offset by more purposeful burning in North America? Why plant trees in some places and burn trees in others?
I mean, that's a complicated question, and there's a lot of competing interest. Yes, fire releases carbon into the atmosphere, and wildfire smoke can be a big contributor to greenhouse gases, or wildfire smoke, it is a greenhouse gas. There needs to be balance. The cause of climate change, in many ways, is not wildfire smoke. It's, you know, industrialized burning. It's the cars and factories and other sources of carbon. I think those are probably the sorts of emissions that we should be thinking about more than how to limit wildfire smoke. Because if we plant or just allow forests to be overgrown, you know, that's potential energy in the system. And, you know, as we saw with the Northern Canadian fires this summer, like once those fires are going in those dense forests, it's near impossible to suppress. So if we're thinking about planting trees to, you know, create carbon offsets, you know, that's a useful mechanism, right? I'm not against trees, but I do think we need to consider the potential risks that that introduces to a system. Are those forests healthy? Are they resilient to burning? Are they planted solely for the purpose of offsetting carbon and not with some sort of natural order in mind? Meaning, are they too dense, maybe too risky as far as the potential for wildfire? Like if a wildfire comes to one of those specifically planted forests, is it natural enough to be resilient to fire on its own, or is it, or are we going to be able to manage a fire in that area if it ever arises? These are hard trade-offs. Without clear answers one way or the other.
Oh, no doubt our listeners would like to hear how they could make their own homes and communities less likely to burn down. What are your top tips, Justin Engel?
Yeah, I think there's a lot we can do to make our homes more resilient to wildfire. And I think the first step in that process is for folks to understand what's the most likely way their house could catch fire. Often in the media, we see portrayals of, you know, huge flames overtaking a home. And that's rarely the way that a home ignites. There's research by a retired Forest Service scientist named Jack Cohen. And he was a pioneer of understanding that the biggest risk to a home is actually a floating ember. And that ember can be wafted from a fire, you know, up to miles away. And that embers tend to find weak spots on your home. That weak spot could be some debris in a gutter. It could be some leaves in a little crevice on your roof. It could be a wooden roof. It could be firewood or scrap wood stacked up under a deck. It could be anything that's flammable that's touching your house. These embers find weak spots, and then your home ignites. If you conceptualize your home as fuel for a fire, then it helps you think about ways to make it more resilient. Cleaning those gutters, getting any vegetation back from the home, surrounding the home maybe with gravel instead of mulch. If you have a wooden roof, be thinking about ways to get rid of that. That is a big expense for many, and I think here in the States, and I'm not sure how it works in Canada, but I think some public investment to help people with wooden roofs replace those roofs, particularly if they're at high-risk zones, is worth consideration. But thinking of, you know, your home and the immediate area around it as a space you need to defend and make it more resilient to wildfire, that can go a long way to protect a home. A lot of folks saw images from the fire in Lahaina in Maui. Now, I got questions often about the so-called miracle home there and why one home was able to survive when everything around it was just burned to the ground. And, you know, there's probably a measure of luck involved in the survival of that home. But if you look at the pictures of that home, you'll immediately notice that it has a rather new-looking metal roof. It's a metal roof that was installed in 2021. You'll also notice that there's no vegetation immediately touching the home or within several feet of it. And there's gravel landscaping around that home. So that home had a lot of defenses built into it, and those defenses probably contributed to its survival. So the key insight there is there's things you can do to harden your home, and there's resources like wildfirerisk.org or firewise.org that outline a lot of the specifics. We outline the specifics in our book.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Montana. Our guest is Dr. Justin Angle, co-author of the new book, This is Wildfire. At last count, 42% of Montana's electricity was generated by coal. You and Nick Mott don't pull any punch on climate's role in pushing wildfires. How does your program go over in a conservative state and on public radio there?
That's a tough one. In Montana, the coal industry is strong here, and not only is the industry strong, but we've built our energy systems around fossil fuels. However, we are seeing a rise in green energy investment. We've got a long tradition of hydropower here in the state of Montana, and that's a form of a renewable. I'm not necessarily a dam advocate, but that is a less carbon-intensive source of energy. We're seeing investment in solar, investment in wind. Particularly as we electrify here, I see more and more electric vehicles around. Cheaper, cleaner, more scalable sources of electricity are going to be in demand, particularly as landowners in the West. You know, the pressure on working private lands in the West is intense, and if there's ways that owners of those working lands can monetize their lands in new ways, maybe through solar and wind, that those are ways that those landowners might become more open to sources of clean energy. It's a hard problem to solve here in Montana and other Western states in the U.S.
Well, as we wrap up, my favorite two parts of your book are the inside scoop on who firefighters are and how they think, plus a handy dictionary of fire lingo. But we should close with your bottom line. What do you hope listeners will take home from your new book about wildfire?
I think there's two things. I think first is we should open our minds up to more fire at more times of the year. Our system is out of balance. Fire has been excluded from our forests. We've built a system that's dedicated to putting out as many fires as possible. And we need our agencies to have license to do more prescribed burning at safe times of the year with enough resources to make them safe. I think the public needs to be more open to that as a solution. The other thing is that we need to not only take responsibility for making our homes, our individual homes, more resilient to fire, but we need to be good neighbors and help our neighbors and community members adopt a similar mentality. And we need to really think long and hard about how we build and where we build. Zoning and codes are tremendously fraught topics here in the American West, but they're topics that need to be addressed. And we're starting to see some of that public process be taken out of our hands by, you know, insurance companies and the mortgage industry to some respects. But yeah, thinking hard about how we build and where we build is important.
From Montana, we've been speaking with Dr. Justin Angle, with his co-author and award-winning co-podcaster Nick Mott. They just released a great manual for the new age of fire. Look for This is Wildfire, How to Protect Yourself, Your Home, and Your Community in the Age of Heat. You can find more links about the book and more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Justin Angle, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks so much, and thanks to all your listeners. I really appreciate the conversation and the thoughtful questions.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Attention, Earthlings. Adrian Parr has a new book for you called Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. You can't fit this book or Adrian into any box. She sounds like an Australian-American with a European education, perhaps. The new work follows her trilogy of three works, Hijacking Sustainability, Wrath of Capital, and The Birth of New Earth. All the while, Adrian is educating people directly with leading roles at the universities of Cincinnati and Texas. She is now Dean of the College of Design at the University of Oregon. Adrian Parr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have advised on city planning and design, and now we find cities are just not designed for extreme rainfall and record-smashing heat. In a superheat wave, for example, there's hardly any shade. The glass offices have no windows. Everybody depends on cooling. Are we not life-dependent, literally, on the power grid and whoever controls that?
Good question. Well, we rely on the power grid and a whole gamut of infrastructure. So you mentioned flooding, and this is directly tied to stormwater infrastructure systems and also, you know, the impermeable surfacing that's blanketing the land, and hard infrastructure replacing, like, important wetlands, for example. So in terms of the power grid, I think the biggest challenge here is how do we shift the energy source that drives the grid from dirty to clean energy, with one that's powered, you know, by renewable energy, for example. So we have the know-how how to make that shift. I think we just need the will to do it. For example, you know, the electricity that powers like Burlington, Vermont or Aspen, Colorado are now, you know, from 100% renewable energy. So if we put together a variety of different sorts of clean energy sources, we can sort of get across the finishing line. And here I'm thinking like a biomass, solar, wind power, and so on and so forth. And
right. And then we have the information grid. I see people in their online life and their followers and they're followed and they're nervously watching screens instead of interacting with real people around them as much. Are we becoming encapsulated, sort of separated like hermits who believe they are part of an online crowd?
Yeah, I think new technologies I don't think are inherently bad or good. I would sort of defer to the way in which Deleuze likes to sort of think about these kinds of problems. And for him, it was all about, you know, how we put things to work. So in the case of technology, how do we use those technologies and the information that we get from them? And in the case of information, I think there's an added layer of whether or not the information is reliable or misleading. And we're very much in a digital information age. And the question of whether or not we can trust the information that we acquire from social media sites is key here. You know, during COVID, access to new technologies and the internet allowed a lot of people to stay connected and to continue their studies and continue working. But COVID also exposed a serious sort of digital deficit, is one way of putting it. You know, I was dean at the time at University of Texas in Dallas-Fort Worth, and many of our students at that institution were from, you know, underrepresented groups and were financially volatile. And the difficulty for me there was how to get laptops into those students' hands, but also how to get access to the internet for them so that they could continue their studies during the global pandemic. So, you know, as a dean, I felt deeply responsible and personally, you know, invested in solving that particular challenge, especially since I was also a first-generation student, and I know, you know, how difficult it is to complete the studies and stay on track if you don't have the resources that you need in order to continue forward. So in that regard, the concern for me is like the digital divide, which is further deepening structures of inequity between those that have access to the internet and to some of the benefits that can come along with that and those that don't. So, you know, that's, of course, like a very different digital situation, I think, to someone who's overusing social media or is using it uncritically. And I think there's been some interesting studies that have been done, for example, on the pleasure that people experience and the systems of sort of reinforcement in things that we already believe in. Like, for example, we know that in the sort of space of social media, there's a feedback loop mechanism that's at play because the way in which it functions is in response to things that you like. So, you know, I always find it amazing if I search for something on the internet and then next thing I know it's appearing in all my feeds as a prompt to purchase whatever it is I was sort of, you know, looking at. You know, that proves that in a way it's much like a sort of narcissistic structure. It's one that kind of feeds you what you want. And it's premised upon, you know, reading all those inputs that you've already created based upon, you know, clicks and likes and shares and so on and so forth. the harmful behavior that's connected to the use of social media comes from an absence of critique. And in many ways, too, it can sort of amplify harmful behaviors and traits and tendencies that people might already have, to be like a social recluse or feelings of anxiety. Also, I think it's tied to feelings of powerlessness. You know, when you're starting to get inundated with a lot of the sort of bad news out there in the world, I can understand why sometimes the general population might feel like there's not much hope to change things. So it's a complicated terrain.
Well, some of us seek comfort in becoming a witness to the times, and science is partly about that. Why could the witness role be dangerous, do you think?
So why can this be dangerous? Well, it's because even, you know, a passive witness on, say, social media has material effects, namely when the information that they're absorbing is incorrect, a lie, or misleading, and a person acts upon it. So it's by being open, and I come back to this idea of critical thinking and engagement again, open to information that might falsify a particularly loud or visible piece of information that's being disseminated and reinforced on social media, I think, where the problems arising from misinformation and disinformation occur, like, you know, the January 6th riots on the Capitol Hill, right? So I suppose what I'm proposing here is a distinction between, like, active and passive witnessing. And the information that comes from passive witnessing, I don't really think it's very valid. I think it's deeply flawed, because in the absence of any critical engagement with the information that social media provides, that information is not that much different to hearsay, rumor, and, you know, even malice. So such a witness, in my view, would be incompetent. But in its worst form, passive witnessing facilitates and has facilitated historically, like, some of the world's greatest forms of violence. And, you know, here I'm thinking of multiple genocides that occurred over the course of human history.
10 years ago, you predicted not revolution in benign consciousness, but, quote, a more virulent strain of capital accumulation on the horizon. Adrian, that appears to be what has happened. Is there a way for it to end?
Yeah, I think that's certainly like a billion-dollar question at the moment, because the challenge is capital is a process. I've talked about that many times, and that's not an idea of mine. That's an idea that comes, you know, extends all the way back to Karl Marx, and has been spoken about by David Harvey. And the idea is, you know, that as a process, capital appropriates the limits that are set to it, including ecological limits. So, you know, at this point, I'd return to a quote by the cultural thinker, and I've used this quote a lot, of Frederick Jamson, who once noted that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And so for me, imagination, as I discussed in Birth of a New Earth, is crucial in, you know, enabling us to try to move past the violence, the exploitation, and the oppression that global capitalism and militarism have given rise to.
You know, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote about good and evil, and he wound up in a hospital for the insane as he got older, and allegedly the incident that tipped him over the edge, the story anyway, is that Nietzsche saw a driver beating his dying horse on the street. Another instance of social insanity seems to have triggered pages of thought in your new book, Earthlings. Can you tell us why happy tourists taking selfies outside a caged polar bear was significant for you?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that people could happily pose in front of, like, a distressed, captured polar bear cub living inside a box with one wall of glass, which was situated inside a mall in China and was permanently on display, I think is profoundly disturbing to me, because I think it casts a light on the inhumanity of humanity, a humanity that's devoid of empathy and compassion, of the animal suffering that they were sort of narcissistically using as a backdrop to attract social media likes, shares, clicks, you know, so on and so forth. And those images of people happily posing before such an, you know, an example of abject misery really sums up, I think, the challenge that we have as a species in moving forward together to bring about environmental justice, not only for humans, but other than human species. I mean, if we're immune to suffering like that, and we're still, you know, we see it as our right to abuse the suffering of another for our own entertainment and enjoyment in this way, I think that strikes to the heart of the challenge that we collectively face when it comes to arriving at the social change that will lead to environmental justice eventually. I mean, a narcissist is incapable of empathy, and without empathy, emancipatory imagination and inclusive politics and a basic sense of common values are all lost.
You wrote three books on the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, and I'm wondering, do we still need the French school of deconstruction to understand the ecologic predicament and other predicaments in our society?
You know, I think there's so much in Deleuze and Guattari's, and I'd like to bring Guattari into the picture as well, because a lot of the work that they wrote together I find really useful in thinking about, you know, the ecological crisis that we're in and its connection to sort of militarism and globalism. And so I think, you know, their thinking is deeply ecological. And I think it's helpful in us trying to sort of formulate a comprehensive understanding of this particular ecological predicament that we're finding ourselves in the 21st century. So, you know, for one, Deleuze's view of, how can I put this, like a differentiating being that's forever changing, but yet it's still one, right, is very much an idea at the heart of the theory of Gaia, for example, where that idea is that the world is like this singular organism that's self-differentiating. That has deep connections to me, for me, in Deleuze's thinking, like around difference and repetition and the role that difference plays in his theory of sort of ontology. And Deleuze and Guattari offer us a view of collaborative sociality that doesn't erase the singularity of individual differences to form this sort of ever-changing, what they call rhizomatic whole. But the social whole, so to speak, is changed through these processes of differentiation, which is basically a theory of inclusive political change, that one that's like not premised upon authoritarianism or sociality being collapsed into some other hierarchical formation. All singularity, all individual differences for Deleuze and Guattari are the effect of this kind of multiplicity of differences. And I think that's a really hopeful idea in our current condition, that's so subsumed by individualism and competition. And it's certainly been something that's been very helpful for me as I've been thinking about processes of commoning and the role that plays in social and political change.
Yes, I'm hearing this often in your work. Apocalyptic fears can consume us, and it must not replace positive imagination for a better world. Would you talk to us more about apocalyptic imagination and emancipatory imagination? How can we feed the good?
Yeah, so as I put those ideas forward, and I think it was in Birth of an Earth, towards the end there, I really laid out the distinction between these sort of two ideas. I was really leaning a lot on Hannah Arendt, and she once noted, you know, like the imagination is political because it enables us to enter the world and reality of another human being. And it pushes us out of our own worldview and into that of another person. And that's sort of connected to what I was saying earlier around the role of empathy too, right? So ultimately, Arendt, and I concur with her on this, there's no politics without being able to include another person's perspectives and experiences in your own view and orientation in the world. And I would add to Arendt, I bring in a trans-speciesist perspective there, and I think, you know, the same applies for the ways in which we try to imagine ourselves in the bodies of other animals and other species. So I think there's a lot in there in terms of forming a will and a collective commitment to peacefully live together with all of our differences. That said, you know, as I discussed in The Birth of a New Earth, imagination is not inherently liberatory. It can be repressive, or it can be emancipatory. So in order to, like, further unpack that idea, I looked to psychoanalysis and more specifically the structure of desire and repression and gratification. And in that context, apocalyptic imagination, as I was describing it, closes the future off to alterity because it's premised upon this sort of insatiable appetite for gratification, a bit like what we were talking about before on sort of social media, you know, likes and clicks and shares and so forth, as that gratification is experienced through, you know, voyeurism, sensationalism, you know, the example of the selfies with the polar bear cub that was stuck in a mall, you know, permanently on display. So, you know, why is that closed? Well, because the imagination is stimulated to the point of terror, I think, or exhilaration. And that builds to this sort of crescendo that finds release in this happy ending minus the critique. So once again, we come back to this idea of critique and critical thinking and examination. And I think, you know, as a structure, apocalyptic imagination turns us inward, in on ourselves. But what we're needing with emancipatory imagination is this sort of act of commoning, a sort of a mode of distributing, like, feeling and memory and emotion and sensation to creatively and sensitively open us up to realities and experiences that are different to our own through the use of empathy and deep feeling, so that we can discover something new about ourselves through the experiences of another being, whether that is human being or another animal. And it allows us then to articulate and experience collective ways of being. So emancipatory imagination for me is central to, you know, other ideas that I've discussed around the role of commoning and empathy in building, you know, a sense of shared collective goals that we're all invested in together.
This is Radio EcoShock from the University of Oregon. We're speaking with Dean Adrienne Parr about her new book, Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. Well, you've talked about critical thinking and about emancipating ourselves with imagination. Are these things that can be taught and learned? How does this get spread out into society in the real world?
We all need to bring our different skill sets to bear in this process. I think, you know, artists have a role to play, philosophers have a role to play, just as much as policymakers, lawyers. There's certainly a really vibrant, growing movement of young people that are now taking the climate case to the courts and arguing that it's endangering the rights that they have to a future that's livable here on Earth. So I do think there are different ways in which we can certainly move the needle on this one so that we start moving together in a positive direction.
Adrienne, you've noted right-wing growth in places like Spain, Germany, and the U.S., places where the left has been formerly strong. Even when people support eliminating subsidies for fossil fuels, millions of them vote for a climate denier as a leader. So the awful question becomes, what happens if the masses desire their own oppression? Your thoughts?
Well, we end up with more and more political leaders who are embraced not for exercising an inclusive and compassionate vision, but for being autocratic and divisive. And I think here Wilhelm Reich is incredibly helpful as we try to grapple with that phenomenon. In The Mass Psychology of Fascism, Reich connected social desire to the reinforcement of patriarchal and authoritarian social structures. And so basically he examined the role that repression and morality play in socialization and how that becomes a political condition that's conducive to the formation and mass support of authoritarian leaders. So, for instance, like a cruel society, not simply the fault, I would say, of an autocratic and cruel leader, I think that kind of leadership structurally aligns with the social field and what the social field desires. So, you know, the wish for authoritarian forms of state power then is linked to, I think, deeper experiences of how patriarchal power and authority are exercised. And that condition is integral to how we, as individuals, are socialized with, you know, the father figure who disciplines the family, for example, is what Reich wrote about. And that then becomes institutionalized in the form of, like, authoritarian rule and social repression.
But maybe we could find ardent environmentalists in some countries who see the time to save ourselves is so short. They might endorse a strong man or woman to dictate social and economic reform on a crash basis for the emergency. What if an authoritarian government is the only way to slash emissions and preserve the last pockets of nature? If that was the only way, would we do it? Or would we perish with our beliefs in democracy and freedom?
You know, I don't think authoritarianism is certainly going to be the way forward in all of this. I think it's important that we're all able to collectively get on the same page and recognize that this is going to take a gargantuan collaborative effort in order to be successful.
Getting back to your ideas of reconnection, the Japanese have programs to reconnect with nature, with conscious walks in the woods, for example. And we know Aboriginal people in North America became other species in their clans, whether a raven or a turtle. It would be great if your technique of imagining life through other species, as you do so brilliantly in this book, if that could become a movement. Maybe this could be part of imagination work in schools and the workplace. Could it help if we could think like a tree or a butterfly?
Oh, I absolutely love this question. Thank you for asking it. Because I think, you know, writing Earthlings fundamentally changed me. Because it awoken me, well, it awoken me my lost child. The one that would naively spend hours watching bugs in the backyard and all manner of life and what it felt like in slow motion. And what I discovered when I wrote the book and as I was entering into the bodies of all these other species, all the while avidly like reading the science behind those material transformations that I was describing, was like this important role that temporality plays in invoking a trans-species ethic. Because ultimately, as you imaginatively enter the body of another being, your own life rhythm changes. And more often than not, this involves slowing down in order to become more aware. So the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely it would help if we could activate affect in this way and that if we could like feel and sense like other species. I think it would deepen our empathy.
A scholar like yourself is part of an intellectual organism consisting of other minds, both living and dead. Who are your contemporaries? Who is part of the Adrian Parr Network?
Well, definitely Santiago Zabala. He's my dear, dear friend and intellectual friend for many, many years. We've written together. We edit a book series together with McGill University Press. We've appeared many times together in public talks and interviews, so I deeply respect his work. Rosie Bray Dottie is also another dear intellectual friend and colleague for many, many years. I first met Rosie when I was putting together the Deleuze Dictionary that would have been 25 years ago now, so that's been a really long intellectual and enriching friendship, and I'm so deeply indebted to her work on posthumanism. I think Brad Evans's work on violence has also, I'm very indebted to that work, and he and I have also had many collaborations together. There are also, though, a lot of artists and designers who I'm also really indebted to. You know, David Rothenberg's work, he's a philosopher artist who plays with other than human species, makes music with them. I mean, incredible, incredible work. Mitch Joachim of Terraform One, the architecture firm, does a lot of trans-species as design work in the built environment that I really admire. So I think, you know, there's a broad span of people there. I mean, last but not least, I'd have to mention my aunt, Julie Rapp, who's a contemporary artist in Australia, and my father, Mike Park, who's also a contemporary artist. I mean, I was really fortunate to be brought up in a very open but also, you know, I would describe a somewhat radical environment as an only child and, you know, spending a lot of time in the studios of both my aunt and my father and learning the benefits that come from, you know, emotion and bringing that into play in the spaces of making things.
Well, reading the book Earthlings, I'm inspired by your insight, but I can't really find a solid take-home message for our listeners. Like a guru, you don't seem to offer a how to get out of this manual. You just make us think. Is that the point?
I think so. I think it's really important that we're able to be clear about what the challenges are. But I also think the new book, Earthlings, is a different kind of book. And I might, you know, I think I've got a copy here. And I think it would be helpful to just maybe read the last little paragraph in the introduction because I think this helps in answering your question. You know, in it I write, art and literature invite us to come alive. Medicine and science try to keep us alive. The law tells us how to live. Politics questions how we live. Religion hopes to give us something to live for. Philosophy pursues how living and nothingness work, tempting us to explore what we love most about life. And the book that I wrote is really a little of all of these things, and hopefully it's something more.
From the University of Oregon, we've been speaking with public intellectual, author, and documentary maker, Dr. Adrian Parr. Look for her new book, Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. You can find more links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. These are, as I wrote in a song several years ago, our time of trials. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Days flow by to our times of trials. Minds in motion with the beat.